This is Focus 580. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. As I said, in the first hour today of Focus, we are going to talk with Daniel Dennett. He's professor of philosophy at Tufts University, where he is also director of the Center for Cognitive Studies. He is interested in a number of things, as I mentioned, in consciousness, in thinking, in artificial intelligence, in religion. He's the author of many articles and a number of books, including Consciousness Explained, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, and Kinds of Minds. His most recent is titled Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, published by Viking last year, and I'm sure you can find it in the bookstore if you'd like to read it. He also was co-founder and co-director of the Curricular Software Studio at Tufts and has helped to design museum exhibits on computers for the Smithsonian, the Museum of Science in Boston, and the Computer Museum in Boston. He is here visiting the campus to give a talk. He'll be talking in the MillerCom series. That will be this afternoon at 4 o'clock in room 112 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus. These programs are always free and open to the public, so anyone who is interested should stop by and hear what he has to say. The title they have put on the talk is The Domestication of Wild Religions, and I'm sure that he'll be talking about some of the same ideas that he has spoken about a lot and written about, particularly in the recent book Breaking the Spell. We are certainly open to questions from people who are listening. You can participate in the conversation very easily by picking up the telephone and calling us, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you for being here.
Delighted to be with you, David.
So much of what we are as human beings, everything from the way that we walk to the way that we think, many people would say, is a process of evolution. And that the process that we call natural selection helped to shape us so that if something seemed to be of value, it was an advantage. It helped individuals to survive. And so then that eventually becomes part of the human repertoire. People argue that's the case for walking upright. But people also, like you, have argued that that is the case with religion, the religious impulse, the tendency to believe in God. What about that, do you think, have been valuable to early humans to the point that now, all these many years later, it's still part of us?
Well, you have to break the question down, I think, because indeed, I think that the phenomena of religion are the products of evolution, but it's several kinds of evolution. There's cultural evolution, which is by biological standards, a very recent phenomenon. We've only had, let's say, 100,000 years of cultural evolution. And before that, we have non-cultural genetic evolution. And many of the features of our minds, of our psyches, many of our habits of thought and attitudes grow out of features that evolved before human beings evolved as a separate species at all. But if we want to talk about which aspects of human psychology laid the foundation for religions, they weren't for belief in God. They were for having the habit, whenever something puzzling or remarkable or surprising or worrying happened, our first instinct is to say, who's there? Who's there? Not what's there, who's there. We tend to personify, to treat as an agent, anything that we don't understand. And there's a very good reason for that, because sometimes when you're startled, it's because there is somebody or something there, and maybe it wants you. And to be able to deal with this uncertainty in the world by treating it, whatever it is, as if it had beliefs and desires and could be either outwitted or reasoned with, is a very potent instinct. It's one, by the way, that you share with your dog. Mm. When the snow falls off the eaves and lands with a thud outside the window, the dog jumps up and growls, "Rawr, who's there?" That's the dog's version. It's the same instinctual version. It's across the mammalian order. In us, unlike the dog goes back to sleep in a minute. In us, it reverberates and reverberates and reverberates. And pretty soon, we've populated the world with lots of invisible agents. Hmm. demons, goblins, fairies, elves, and so forth, talking trees and so forth. Those are the ancestors of organized religion. That's just superstition. But those, that menagerie of imaginary agents is the, that's as it were, the gene pool, the meme pool for the gods that then become more recently, for many organized, but not all organized religion, the monotheistic god.
Yeah. Then I guess one might ask, the next question one might ask is, how it is you go from what is, what may very well be a very individual kind of response to a particular situation to the, to a more organized kind of system of belief where you have a group of individuals that have, that share some sense of belief in common, so that everybody, so when something happens, that instead of everyone having some different kind of explanation, that generally speaking, everyone agrees on one explanation.
Yeah, and that's where the cultural evolution comes in. The genetic evolution explains the bias in favor of agents. One author calls this the hyperactive agent detection device that we have in our heads. I call it the intentional stance, adopting the intentional stance. And it, but that just serves as a ground. But then, since we have language, and I think religion can't really predate language, we can compare notes, we can talk, and we can pass our ideas, the individual responses we've had, to each other. And pretty soon, the community has a shared group of agents. And then other evolutionary forces begin to structure that panoply, that menagerie of agents and ideas. And at this point, the phenomena are not organized. They're wild. They're being spread from person to person, but they're being spread more the way we spread germs than the way we teach doctrine. The whole idea of the deliberate teaching of creeds and so forth is a much later phenomenon, and that's what I'm going to be talking about this afternoon.
Yeah.
And many of the features of modern religions, of organized religions, of branches of Christianity, I think we can see, if you like, the fossil traces of their earliest ancestral forms, back before there was writing and back before there was organized religion. Because in the early days, these ideas sort of had to fend for themselves. They weren't domesticated. They were like squirrels and pigeons, very well evolved to live in the human niche with us, to share our part of the world, but not ours. We are not their protectors. And in the same way, the early ideas that turned into religion, the early wild religions, were not under the protection of anybody.
Yeah. This is, I think, an interesting idea that you talk about, and it may be something that would be difficult for people to wrap their heads around, the idea that ideas can act like viruses. That is, they can infect your mind and not only then become part of your thinking, but that they can then jump from one person to another. So you can start with something that is just one person's idea in a group, and given the right circumstances, you can get to the point where everyone in the group says, oh, yeah, that makes sense to me. That must be the way it is. And suddenly it becomes a kind of a group idea.
Yeah, and not only that, but the spreading doesn't have to include that sort of judicious assessment, which says, yeah. I mean, just think, to take an obvious case, you're walking down the street, and you find this terrible tune running through your head. You're sort of humming it to yourself. And the Germans have a nice word for it. They call it an earworm. And, it's, you can't get it out of your head. And then, maybe out of maliciousness, you sing it to somebody else. And now they can't get it out of their head. And this is the sort of extreme case where an idea can spread around in a population even though nobody professes to like it. Nobody thinks it's better than silence, as it were. But there it is. It has managed. I'm using my words carefully. It has managed to find a weakness in our psyches that it can exploit in the same way that viruses and germs find chinks in our armor and then exploit them and get them spread. When you sneeze, who's that for? Who benefits from the sneeze? Well, the sneezing reflex evolved to rid the nasal passages of foreign things that aren't good for it. But the provocation of a sneeze by a cold virus, this is benefiting the virus. Now, it doesn't know that. It doesn't have to have a mind. But it has been designed to get you to broadcast it, and that's the way it spreads from host to host. And so we already know that things that are completely mindless, I mean, a virus, after all, is not even alive. It's just a macromolecule. Mm-hmm. But it's designed in such a way that it provokes a certain effect which gets it to replicate again and again and again and to spread. And ideas can do the same thing. They can be spread, and you say, but what's an idea made of? Well, it's made of information, but it has to have a physical embodiment of one sort or another in an individual brain or in sound waves or in a visible gesture. There are many ways of physically providing vehicles for information, but it's the information that replicates.
Going back to the idea that when you talked about the your idea about the origins of folk religion having being rooted in the fact that human beings, as we go through the world and we have experiences and we see things happen, we assume agency.
Yeah.
We think someone is behind this thing happening. And you can understand that would indeed have survival value because you figure in our early history, we would have to be concerned about predators. So if something happens, we need to make sure that this is not something that wants to eat us. So, and then if we don't see any obvious cause, then we sort of don't trust that. We say, no, there's something's got to be going on here. So maybe it's something that I can't see or something that is hidden, something that's not obvious. So you can understand that kind of thinking and that having a definite survival value. How, though, then do you make the argument that when this continues to develop and we have an organized religion, we have temples, we have rituals, we have a priesthood, we have an evolved system of beliefs, certain rules for behavior, certain principles around which we organize our society, all of that, you would, I think, then still have to make the argument that as it continues to develop and grow, continues to have a survival value, or else it would go away.
No, careful.
Ah.
Yeah, it would go away unless something is getting a replicative benefit here. Something, it's the fitness of something that has to be rung in, but it doesn't have to be us. People, when I first started working on this particular topic, the evolution of religion, and people would say to me, oh, that's very interesting. I've often wondered what good religion is for us. It's not obvious, but every human group that's ever been studied has religion, so it must be good for something. I said, no. That's an elementary evolutionary mistake. Every human group that's ever been studied has the common cold, too. What's that good for? It's good for itself. It replicates because it can. Now, we have today not just the common cold, but we have all manner of cold remedies and advertising. There's a huge infrastructure surrounding the common cold. What's it good for? Well, it's good for dealing with a common cold. As a worst-case scenario, maybe the whole structure of organized religions is just our species' way of dealing with a particularly profligate mind virus, which is religions. Maybe it doesn't do us any good at all. But when we think about the fact that we have domesticated these early ideas, then it begins to look as if at least we think it's doing good, and now we can begin to look at the same ideas, or rather at their descendants, as sort of domesticated species. Now, when we domesticate a species, it's good. Now, we at least think it's good for us. And maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. We want to approach these questions with a level playing field. One of the main points of my book and of the work I've been doing in the last few years is to say, by all means, let's study the hypothesis, which most people believe, that religion is good for the world. Maybe it is. The only way to show that it is, and not just assume that it is to start with a level playing field and demonstrate that it actually is good, not that it survives because it can survive.
Let me again introduce our guest for this hour of Focus 580, Daniel Dennett. He is professor of philosophy at Tufts University. If you would like to read more on this subject, you can look for his most recent book, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, published by Viking last year. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore. He'll be talking on the same subject as part of the Millarcom series this afternoon at 4 in room 112 of Gregory Hall on the U of I campus, and that's open to anyone who is interested. And we are open to questions and thoughts from people who are listening. 333-9455 is the number. Just call in on the show. And we also do have a toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Either way, whichever of those works best for you, you can call. You will come right here to this program. No one will expect you to give a pledge. That would be nice, but it is not required. Let us bring in some folks here who are listening, and I will start here with a caller, I presume someone local here on line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Thank you for having Dr. Dennett on. I've read Breaking the Spell. I recommend it to everybody. It's a wonderful book.
Thank you.
A question kept going through my mind as I was reading it, I was wondering if you could address it. How do you think the knowledge that people have that they're going to die figure into the development of religion?
That's a good question. And
I'll turn off the air.
All right. Thank you for the call.
I think that's an important question. And first of all, I think we're probably the only species on the planet that has the capacity to understand that clearly. Other species see death all around them and may have some inkling, but we're the ones that really have the imaginations to think about this. And I think that to continue a line of thought that I was mentioning a few minutes ago, when we look around the world, or when we look at those we love, say, we have a very powerful habit of trying to read their minds, trying to think about what they want, what they believe, what they desire, how they would react, how they are reacting things. If you're out with a friend or a family member or loved one or something, and sometimes you say, "Did you see what I just saw? What do you think about this?" We are constantly filling our own heads with our hunches about what's in the heads of others. Those are deeply ingrained, involuntary habits. When somebody dies, when a loved one dies, this is, of course, a time of turmoil, because on the one hand, a corpse is something to retreat from, it's actually dangerous after decay is set in, and so we are repelled from the corpse, and yet this is a loved one, and so we're drawn to it. So we're in a sort of crisis, being torn in two ways, and those habits don't go away, so we can't turn them off. We go on thinking, what would she want? What is she thinking now? What would she say to this that's going on now? And I think that those habits are really the source in our evolved psychology of what you might even call the hallucination of a spirit or soul that lives on after death. And it's no accident, I'm sure, that the gods in folk religions are almost invariably maybe invariably, I don't know offhand, I'm not enough of a scholar to know, there must be some exceptions, their ancestors. And the elevation of ancestors into a divine role is a really ubiquitous feature of folk religions. And the idea of an afterlife is also ubiquitous, and I think this is its source.
It certainly can be argued that over human history, evil has been done in the name of religion. I don't think that there... We might find some religion that would be guiltless. I think it might be difficult. At the same time, people would say that religious values have helped to promote peaceful coexistence among people, values like respect for human life and human rights, and that religious values do help to give structure to an orderly society. So some people would make the argument that says, you know, a commandment that says, thou shalt not kill, well, that's probably a pretty good thing because at least it prevents widespread murder, not all, but, you know, that it's helpful. So, you know, given the fact that we might argue that there are positive aspects to religion, would you accept an argument that says that we need it, that it would not be a good thing if all religion were to disappear from the world tomorrow?
Oh, I would certainly take any such argument very seriously, and I, to this day, am actually agnostic about that issue. I am not at all confident that a world without religion would be a better place than the world we now inhabit. To me, it seems to be much more important to identify the varieties of religion, and this is in every denomination, in every variety, that are toxic, that are really dangerous, and see if we can't encourage their extinction and foster the survival of descendant religions that are, in fact, even more valuable. I think that is, in fact, the natural wise strategy to think of in a sort of public health spirit. We don't want to get rid of all our germs. We die. We want to get rid of the ones that are really toxic and dangerous, the malignant ones, and we want the benign ones to thrive. And we should feel the same way about social phenomena, including, of course, religious phenomena. Many of them are benign. Let's see if we can favor those and encourage the departure, the extinction of the versions that are really bad for us. And the only way we can do that, though, and this is the whole point of my book, is if we really understand how religions work. If we just lash out and with the best of intentions and try to fix things, we may end up making matters much worse. That's why if you want religions to survive and thrive in the future, you should pay very close attention to religion as a natural phenomenon, because your efforts to further that may be, if they're misinformed, you may do more harm than good.
Yeah. And another one of the basic arguments you make is that religion is a worthy and important subject for serious study, and that in the past it's been neglected.
Yeah, not just neglected. There's been a revered tradition of neglect. That is to say, it's considered bad form, not just impolite, but impious and aggressive and sacrilegious, to look at religion with the cool, calm, objective eye of science. And I'm saying that's the spell that we have to break. That's mm-hmm. the meaning of the title. We should look at religion with the same scientific intensity and objectivity that we look at water policy, global warming, energy policy, poverty. All of these are hugely important phenomena, and we owe it to our descendants to study them with all the tools at our disposal.
We have several callers and perhaps about 15 minutes left. So again, callers will help us by being brief. That way we can get in as many people as possible. In fact, the lines are now all full. We will try and accommodate as many people as we can. Starting in here with Bloomington, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hi. You base your whole argument on the supposed non-existence of a personal intelligence. At the start of the program, you just dismissed the possibility of a personal intelligence. There are two categories of compelling evidence for a personal intelligence. The first category is the finite universe, a universe finite, not eternal, exquisitely designed to accommodate life by accident. In other words, we have natural laws that accommodate life, the mass density of the universe adjusted to breathtaking precision so that galaxies will form, so stars and planets will form. We have the existence of something called chemistry. We have elements with the correct chemistry for life, and just by accident, the correct abundance of those right elements in our universe. And this universe had a beginning. It's not eternal. So it had to be created. Was it created with all this precision complexity by accident? That's just one category of compelling evidence. The next category of compelling evidence is life itself. And life, all modern life, appears in the fossil record with a bang, to quote Harvard's Stephen Jay Gould, not by gradual evolution, not with evolutionary ancestors, but with a bang. And even the least complex life, if life had occurred by accident sometime in the distant past, that even the least complex life form is far more complex than a supercomputer. Did that kind of precision complexity occur by accident, or did it have to be designed?
Well, you've given the guest a lot to respond to. Let's give him the chance.
Yep. Well, you're right that in this talk today and in my book, I don't go into all the arguments for how a scientific evolutionary perspective can account for the so-called fine-tuning of the universe. I've gone into that in other work. In my book, Darwin's Dangerous Idea, I talk at some length about how the whole thing could get started. And yes, the universe is not the knowable universe is not eternal. It had a beginning, but there's good scientific reasons for saying that beginning was in effect an accident, one of many accidents, and it didn't come into existence all perfectly designed. This would take us way away from what my current book is about. But actually, although I assume a scientific point of view, I don't assume the falsehood so much of a personal, intelligent God as I maintain a complete neutrality about that. It's always possible that the evolution of all these ideas by wonderful good fortune or even by design happened because there was an intelligent designer out there that wanted it to happen. But the only way we could ever get any good evidence for that is by not assuming that, and then showing that we can't explain things without backing up on that assumption. After all, when the Catholic Church wants to prove that somebody is a saint, they have a devil's advocate who tries to show no, he's not, or she's not, and you have to start with a level playing field, and so that's where I start, and it leaves the question of whether or not in the end there is a personal God, whether that's true, leaves that wide open.
I must move on. We have a number of others, and again, we're getting short on time. Just very quickly, though, I'd like to introduce again our guest, Daniel Dennett. He is professor of philosophy at Tufts University. He's director of the Center for Cognitive Studies there. He's authored a number of books dealing with this subject. Let me just mention the last one, if you'd like to read it, Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, was published last year by Viking. And for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, he'll be giving a talk this afternoon about these ideas. So you'll have a chance to hear more. We do need to get on to some other folks here. We'll go next to line one. This is in Belgium, the community nearby. Hello.
Yes. Do I understand what you're saying then, sir, is that God created Earth and then man returned the favor?
No, the second half is right. Man created God, or at least that's the defeasible hypothesis with which I'm working. Although it wasn't a deliberate creation, any more than language was a deliberate creation. Nobody invented language Every now and then somebody coins a word, but most of the words were never coined by anybody. They have no authors. And I think the same thing is true of our underlying ideas of God. They are the descendants of ideas which are much older and much different and quite simpler. These ideas emerged by a process of cultural evolution on top of a process of genetic evolution, which brought us to Homo sapiens in the first place.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, to Urbana. This is line two. Hello.
Oh, hello. How are you? I admire your fortitude. I guess the caller earlier was a little impolite. But is your idea similar to Richard Dawkins's memes theory?
Memes, yes, it is. In fact, I didn't use the word until now. Maybe I did. But indeed, I am one of the people that's taken Richard Dawkins' idea of memes and has tried to develop it further.
Okay. But as you were talking about historically about religion, I have a coin of phrase that I sort of was – I talked to a lot of friends about this, that I think you could say beliefs change, facts stay the same. So the argument now is about are beliefs valid, you know, historically. I mean the current beliefs such as Christianity – Islam, et cetera, the monotheistic and the polytheism, all this sort of things. And prior to that, where there were no definable terms to describe these through, like early Homo sapiens worshiping trees or whatever, pantheism or whatever you want to call it now. But when science came along, science had a methodology to say not true, true, not true, sort of like in mathematics, you know, proof or fact, et cetera, using those terms like that. So repeatable methodologies, unlike religion, which is you believe it or you don't. So, I mean, when you look at religion to me historically, you see people changing, you know, beliefs sort of have come to monotheism, sort of like the truth through Judaism and things like that. But I'm just wondering what you think about that.
Well, let me just concentrate on a couple of points mm-hmm. there. If we go back and look at, say, tribal cultures, in the early days of what I'm calling folk religion, there wasn't any distinction between religion and science. There was just what everybody knew or thought they knew. There was all this, the lore, and you learned your natural history the same way, and which included both what we would today call biological facts about the behavior and habits of species and so forth, but also the gods associated with them and what rituals you had to go through before you went out to hunt them and that sort of thing. And the division between science and religion is a sort of later, a much more recent development. And you put, I think, your finger on part of it. One of the most unnatural acts in the world is to put forward a hypothesis, and then when the hypothesis is strongly disconfirmed by evidence, say, oh, gosh, I guess I was wrong. But it's the very basis of science, whereas the more natural thing to do is to revise your hypothesis so that you end up still being right, and just to keep revising and revising and revising. And so it's no accident that we see, I think, in every religion, systematically irrefutable claims. That is, the points of dogma are not just, they don't just happen to be not subject to empirical confirmation or disconfirmation. This is systematic, and they even have more doctrine which says why we can't confirm these and so forth. And that whole imperviousness to empirical investigation is not an accident. It is a design feature that has evolved of specifically religious ideas.
Yeah, I agree. I really admire your intellect, and I've read your stuff before, and your approach is very interesting, and I think it's factual, too. Thank you.
All right, thank you. We'll go on to someone else here. This is a caller in Charleston, and it's line three. Hello.
Yes. George Hegel, of whom Marx was a student, evolved the dialectic, and if I'm reading the stuff right, his was a dialectic of mysticism, whereas Marx was the dialectic of the material world. And this seems to me, or I'm picking up that throughout this program and your guest's ideas, that that this is the progress that needs to be sought and to find solutions and answers both of the society and the natural world that we live in. I'll hang up and take my hear it on the air. Thank you.
All right.
That's a very interesting observation. The materialism of modern science is often viewed with great fear by people who are fond of mystical ideas or fond of immaterialism as a spiritual idea. And I think this is a fundamental confusion in human culture. The association of materialism with a sort of Philistine, reductionistic, mind-numbing, mind-denying point of view. There have certainly been crude and ineffective and even vicious materialisms in the past, just as there have been vicious idealisms and mysticisms and dualisms. My work is designed to show that all the really important and valuable and cherishable features of human culture, human mind, ethics, and so forth can be grounded in the material world by understanding how they evolved. They all had to evolve. Billions of years ago, there was no ethics, there was no art, there was no music. Today, there is all of that, and love. These are all evolved features of the world, and it's not just genes. There's cultural evolution as well. And the finest, most glorious creations of the human spirit are not spiritual in any anti-material sense. They're spiritual in the sense of being so richly endowed with the kinds of meanings that have evolved on this planet.
Just, I'm interested in asking a question about mystical experience. And it, from probably throughout all history, different people, different times, who come from different kinds of mystical, religious, philosophical traditions, have talked about the feeling that there is something greater than they, something outside of themselves, that somehow they have managed to connect with, or at least to appreciate the feeling that they are connected with it, and that it's something that somehow involves and encompasses all living things. I suppose one might argue that that kind of a feeling, that tendency to that feeling, is just an artifact of the way our brains are constructed. And it's simply that. Other people would point to the fact that may be that because people have that experience and have long had that experience, that maybe that tells us that there actually is something that they're connecting with.
I think that feeling of just breathless awe at the wonder of it all and the sense of gratitude that we're here, that all of this can be here, is actually better supported by a detailed scientific knowledge of how we got here and how the parts actually work. What we now are beginning to learn about how the billions of neurons in our brains create our minds, much more awe-inspiring than the sort of shallow myth of an immaterial and completely incomprehensible ghost spirit bit of wonder stuff. That's not properly awe-inspiring. That's just, quite frankly, cheesy. It's like the difference between Superman and great literature.
Well, I want to get at least one more person here who is hanging on, waiting. Rantoul, line one. Hello.
Oh, good morning. My name is Tom. I listen most to your show. I'd like to use the word ontology, which you know. Could I quickly define it out of a book, 50 Major Philosophers, second edition? Ontology, the study of existence in its broadest sense, in the inquiry into large categories of existing things and drawing of distinctions between what kind things exist. And it's, between religion and philosophy, I think it does bind them together in certain areas. I'm fascinated with religions. I myself am a conservative biblical Christian, which simply means that I believe the Holy Scriptures, I believe I'm a sinner, and I need Jesus Christ's atoning sacrifice on the cross to save me. But I also have believe there's a difference between the people in the various religions, and religions in the world consist of two groups. One group is a religion created by man, of which man essentially comes some form of a godhood or various gods, and there's always conflicts between them, and man's worship of these gods involve violence, sacrifice, and constantly changing. And then in religion, there's a God of the Bible, who is the creator, the intelligent designer, and if you study the Holy Scriptures carefully, and I would say that the Masoretic text and a received Greek New Testament text would be the most accurate ones, there is no violence that's used to worship that God. There's only a God of love and the design of behavior involving people love each other first, love God first and love each other, and it's a constant goal. There's no sacrifices of violence or no violence against one another that's constantly recommended in two basic religions. Then I'd like to make a comment about Karl Marx and Friedrich Hegel. Marx, very intelligent man, and a man who would be commended for being a very faithful to his wife and his family. But one thing about the dialectic of the proletariat and the bourgeoisie was the proletariat and the bourgeoisie had a mysticism connection that he didn't see, and that is Christianity. And it took over 100 years later for an Italian communist named Antonio Gramsci to come up with an idea, we need to Marxize religion and get Christianity out of the culture. Then maybe someday
I hate to do this to you, caller, but I'm going to have to jump in and give the opportunity to the guest to make some response, because we're very close to the point where we're going to have to stop.
Well, there's some interesting ideas. There may be a lot in what you say. The one thing I think you said that raised a red flag for me was when you said, well, you have to read the Bible carefully. Well, there's so many different ways of reading the Bible carefully, and no three people are going to agree on that. Well, you can get three, but you can't get everybody. And that's one of the problems with texts that are considered sacred texts, is that they contain a multitude. And they even well known that the devil can quote scripture, so better just not to assume that any text is sacred, and treat them all as defeasible, wonderful sources of all kinds of information, and then we can judge, as we've been doing for thousands of years, which aspects we're going to take seriously now.
Do you think that, my apology, I have to give you a very short time to answer the question, that the religious impulse could actually be something that is genetically encoded in human beings?
Oh, I think to some degree, although I expect there's a lot of variation. The idea that there might be a strong survival advantage, this is a genetic fitness benefit, mm-hmm. to being susceptible to ritual, say, is one of the ideas that I pursue in the book. And there would be good reason to be susceptible to ritual, because in the early days of shamanic healing, which was in all religions, the ritual of the presentation of whatever the herbs or the potions or the smoke, whatever the rituals were, they really did have a strong placebo effect. And if you were just immune to that, if you just didn't have the capacity to be moved by that, you didn't have any health insurance.
I'm sorry, we're going to have to stop. For people who would like to hear more from our guest, Daniel Dennett, he will be talking on this subject this afternoon at 4 o'clock as part of the MillerCom series 112 Greg Hall. Anyone interested can stop by. And also, if you'd like to look at his most recent book, it is Breaking the Spell, Religion as a Natural Phenomenon, published last year by Viking. So you can get some sense of his ideas. Thank you very much.
Thank you.